That's the great lady of the Hammond organ, Shirley Scott, laying beautiful foundation for Eddie Lockjaw Davis and later Jerome Richardson on flute on this gorgeous piece of music titled Skillet. It's from Davis's cookbook series. This is from Volume 2, released in 1958. George Duvivier on bass and Arthur Edgehill on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, September the 29th. And the president is facing a pretty big backlash with regard to his statement that the United States underestimated the threat of ISIS and also overestimated the willingness of the Iraqi army to fight ISIS, or the Islamic State, whichever it is you choose to call them. So it kind of gives a clue that there is something dramatically wrong within the circle of the president when all of these decisions are being made, and yet you have this admission. He said this to Steve Croft, CBS correspondent. It aired on 60 Minutes just last night. And what is interesting is that while there's a huge furor about it, back on June the 12th, Hillary Clinton said the exact same thing with respect to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. She said it at the Council on Foreign Relations. I remembered it, and I stashed it in my memory, and there it was. On June the 12th, she said that a Secretary of State, a former Secretary of State and presidential candidate, she said that the United States underestimated Al-Qaeda and underestimated the whole terrorist community and their campaigns. So one wonders, how is it that you have access to all these methods of intelligence gathering? You couldn't ask for better, funded by billions and billions of taxpayer dollars. And the Secretary of State says it in June. The president says it now in September. But I don't recall that Hillary got pilloried for this, for saying so. But, you know, it's a different strokes for different folks kind of thing. But I want to talk about the Wizard of Odd. That's our president. And some very strange things are going on. And you know, it's hard to make sense of it. But every now and then, he gives a nice little hint of what is in his head. And we got a hint of that yesterday at the Congressional Black Caucus Dinner. It is the annual festival of self-congratulation and political subservience to the Democratic Party. And he was a keynote speaker. And I want to share with you what he said and come back to it when he's done and really talk about the significance of the speech. Now, I know it is a bit of, it's torture listening to the speeches. More and more, it is becoming a torturous experience. But if you listen closely, you will hear some very interesting things. So here's the president at the dinner last night. Of course, it's all about his home, as it were. The president has come home, and home to his peeps, you know. And he's talking. he's being black for the night, and he's sharing with his people. And he's among his people and giving them deep, deep words of wisdom and advice. Here's your president speaking to the Congressional Black Caucus last night.
By paying special tribute to a man with whom all of you have worked closely with, someone who served his country for nearly 40 years as a prosecutor, as a judge, and as Attorney General of the United States, Mr. Eric Holder. Throughout his long career in public service, Eric has built a powerful legacy of making sure that equal justice under the law actually means something, that it applies to everybody, regardless of race or gender or religion or color, creed, disability, sexual orientation. He has been a great friend of mine. He has been a faithful servant of the American people. We will miss him badly. This year, we've been marking the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. We honor giants like John Lewis, unsung heroines like Evelyn Lowry. We honor the countless Americans, some who are in this room, black, white, students, scholars, preachers, housekeepers, patriots all, who with their bare hands reached into the well of our nation's founding ideals and helped to nurture a more perfect union. We've reminded ourselves that progress is not just absorbing what has been done, it's advancing what's left undone. Even before President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law, even as the debate dragged on in the Senate, he was already challenging America to do more and march further to build a great society. One, Johnson said, where no child will go unfed and no youngster will go unschooled. Where no man who wants to work will fail to find it. Where no citizen will be barred from any door because of his birthplace or his color or his church. Where peace and security is common among neighbors and possible among nations. This is the world that waits for you, he said. Reach out for it now. Join the fight to finish the unfinished work. To finish the unfinished work. America's made stunning progress since that time, over the past 50 years, even over the past 5 years, but it is the unfinished work that drives us forward. Some of our unfinished work lies beyond our borders. America's leading the effort to rally the world against Russian aggression in Ukraine. America's leading the fight to contain and combat Ebola in Africa. America's building and leading the coalition that will degrade and ultimately destroy the terrorist group known as ISIL. As Americans, we are leading, and we don't shy away from these responsibilities. We welcome them. That's what America does. And we are grateful to the men and women in uniform who put themselves in harm's way in service of the country that we all love. So we've got unfinished work overseas, but we've got some unfinished work right here at home. After the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, our businesses have now created 10 million new jobs over the last 54 months. This is the longest uninterrupted stretch of job growth in our history. In our history. But we understand our work's not done until we get the kind of job creation that means everybody who wants to work can find a job. We've done some work on health care, too. I don't know if you've noticed. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, we've seen a 26% decline in the uninsured rate in America, African Americans have seen a 30% decline. And by the way, the cost of health care isn't going up as fast anymore either. Everybody was predicting this is all going to be so expensive. We've saved $800 billion in Medicare because of the work that we've done, slowing the cost, improving quality, improving access. Despite unyielding opposition, this change has happened just in the last couple of years. But we know our work's not yet done until we get into more communities, help more uninsured folks get covered, especially in those states where the governors aren't being quite as cooperative as we'd like them to be. You know who we are. It always puzzles me where you decide to take a stand to make sure poor folks in your state can't get health insurance, even though it doesn't cost you a dime. That doesn't make much sense to me, but I won't go on that topic. We've got more work to do. It's easy to take a stand when you've got health insurance. I'm going off script now, but that's what happens at the CBC. Our high school graduation rate is at a record high. The dropout rate is falling. More young people are earning college degrees than ever before. Last year, the number of children living in poverty fell by 1.4 million, the largest decline since 1966. Since I took office, the overall crime rate and the overall incarceration rate has gone down by about 10%. That's the first time they've declined at the same time in more than 40 years. Fewer folks in jail, crime still going down. But our work's not done when too many children live in crumbling neighborhoods, cycling through substandard schools, traumatized by daily violence. Our work's not done when working Americans of all races have seen their wages and income stagnate even as corporate profits soar, when African-American unemployment is still twice as high as white unemployment, when income inequality on the rise for decades continues to hold back hardworking communities, especially communities of color. We've got unfinished work. And we know what to do. That's the worst part. We know what to do. We know we've got to invest in infrastructure and manufacturing and research and development that creates new jobs. We've got to keep rebuilding a middle-class economy with ladders of opportunity so that hard work pays off and you see higher wages and higher incomes and fair pay for women doing the same work as men, and workplace flexibility for parents in case a child gets sick or a parent needs some help. We've got to build more Promise Zone partnerships to support local revitalization of hard-hit communities. We've got to keep investing in early childhood education. We want to bring preschool to every four-year-old in this country. And we want every child to have an excellent teacher. And we want to invest in our community colleges and expand Pell Grants for more students. And I'm going to keep working with you to make college more affordable because every child in America, no matter who she is, no matter where she's born, no matter how much money her parents have, ought to be able to fulfill her God-given potential. That's what we believe. So I just want everybody to understand, we have made enormous progress. There's almost no economic measure by which we are not better off than when I took office. Unemployment down, deficits down, uninsured down, poverty down, energy production up, manufacturing back, auto industry back. But I just list these things just so if you have a discussion with one of your friends and they're confused. Stock market up. Corporate balance sheet strong. In fact, the folks who are doing the best, they're the ones who complain the most. So you can just point these things out, but we still have to close these opportunity gaps. And we have to close the justice gap. How justice is applied, but also how it is perceived, how it is experienced. Eric Holder understands this. That's what we saw in Ferguson this summer when Michael Brown was killed and the community was divided. We know that the unrest continues, and Eric spent some time with the residents and police of Ferguson, and the Department of Justice has indicated that its civil rights investigation is ongoing. Now, I won't comment on the investigation. I know that Michael's family's here tonight. I know that nothing any of us can say can ease the grief of losing a child so soon. But the anger and the emotion that followed his death awakened our nation once again to the reality that people in this room have long understood, which is in too many communities around the country, a gulf of mistrust exists between local residents and law enforcement. Too many young men of color feel targeted by law enforcement. Guilty of walking while black or driving while black, judged by stereotypes that fuel fear and resentment and hopelessness. We know that statistically, in everything from enforcing drug policy to applying the death penalty to pulling people over, there are significant racial disparities. That's just the statistics. One recent poll showed that the majority of Americans think the criminal justice system doesn't treat people of all races equally. Think about that. That's not just blacks, not just Latinos or Asians or Native Americans saying things may not be fair. That's most Americans. And that has a corrosive effect, not just on the black community. It has a corrosive effect on America. It harms the communities that need law enforcement the most. It makes folks who are victimized by crime and need strong policing reluctant to go to the police because they may not trust them. And the worst part of it is it scars the hearts of our children. Scars the hearts of white children who grow unnecessarily fearful of somebody who doesn't look like them. Stains the heart of black children who feel as if no matter what he does, he'll always be under suspicion. That is not the society we want. It's not the society that our children deserve. Whether you're black or white, you don't want that for America. It was interesting. Ferguson was used by some of America's enemies and critics to deflect attention from their own shortcomings overseas, to undermine our efforts to promote justice around the world. They said, well, look at what's happening to you back home. But as I said this week at the United Nations, America's special not because we're perfect. America's special because we work to address our problems, to make our union more perfect. We fight for more justice. We fight to cure what ails us. We fight for our ideals, and we're willing to criticize ourselves when we fall short. And we address our differences in the open space of democracy with respect for the rule of law, with a place for people of every race and religion, and with an unyielding belief that people who love their country can change it. That's what makes us special, not because we don't have problems, but because we work to fix them. And we will continue to work to fix this. And to that end, we need to help communities and law enforcement build trust, build understanding, so that our neighborhoods stay safe and our young people stay on track. And under the leadership of Eric Holder, the Justice Department has launched a national effort to do just that. He's also been working to make the criminal justice system smarter and more effective by addressing unfair sentencing disparities, changing department policies on charging mandatory minimums, promoting stronger reentry programs for those who've paid their debt to society. And we need to address the unique challenges that make it hard for some of our young people to thrive. For all the success stories that exist in a room like this one, we all know relatives, classmates, neighbors who were just as smart as we were, just as capable as we were, born with the same light behind their eyes, the same joy, the same curiosity about the world, but somehow they didn't get the support they needed or the encouragement they needed, or they made a mistake or they missed an opportunity. They weren't able to overcome the obstacles that they faced. And so in February, we launched My Brother's Keeper. And I was the first one to acknowledge government can't play the only or even the primary role in the lives of our children, but what we can do is bring folks together, and that's what we're doing. Philanthropies, business leaders, entrepreneurs, faith leaders, mayors, educators, athletes, and the youth themselves to examine how can we ensure that our young men have the tools they need to achieve their full potential. And next week I'm launching My Brother's Keeper Community Challenge, asking every community in the country, big cities and small towns, rural counties, tribal nations, publicly commit to implementing strategies that will ensure all young people can succeed, starting from cradle all the way to college and a career. It's a challenge to local leaders to follow the evidence and use the resources on what works for our kids. And we've already got 100 mayors, county officials, tribal leaders, Democrats, Republicans signed on. And we're going to keep on signing them up in the coming weeks and months. But they're going to need you, elected leaders, business leaders, community leaders, to make this effort successful. We need all of us to come together to help all of our young people address the variety of challenges they face. And we're not forgetting about the girls, by the way. I got two daughters, I don't know if you've noticed. African-American girls are more likely than their white peers also to be suspended, incarcerated, physically harassed. Black women struggle every day with biases that perpetuate oppressive standards for how they're supposed to look and how they're supposed to act. Too often, they're either left under the hard light of scrutiny or cloaked in a kind of invisibility. So in addition to the new efforts on My Brother's Keeper, the White House Council for Women and Girls has for years been working on issues affecting women and girls of color, from violence against women to pay equity to access to health care. And you know Michelle's been working on that because she doesn't think our daughters should be treated differently than anybody else's sons. I've got a vested interest in making sure that our daughters have the same opportunities as boys do. So that's the world we got to reach for. The world where every single one of our children has the opportunity to pursue their measure of happiness. That's our unfinished work. And we're going to have to fight for it. We've got to stand up for it. And we have to vote for it. We have to vote for it. All around the country, wherever I see folks, they always say, "Oh, Barack, we're praying for you. Boy, you're so great. Look, you got all gray hair. You're looking tired. We're praying for you." Which I appreciate. But I tell them, after President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he immediately moved on to what he called the meat in the coconut, a Voting Rights Act bill. And some of his administration argued that's too much, it's too soon. But the movement knew that if we rested after the Civil Rights Act, then all we could do was pray that somebody would enforce those rights. So whenever I hear somebody say they're praying for me, I say, "Thank you. Thank you. I believe in the power of prayer." But we need more than prayer. We need to vote. We need to vote. That will be helpful. It will not relieve me of my gray hair, but it'll help me pass some bills. Because people refused to give in when it was hard, we get to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act next year. Until then, we've got to protect it. We can't just celebrate it, we've got to protect it. Because there are people still trying to pass voter ID laws to make it harder for folks to vote. We've got to get back to our schools and our offices, our churches, our beauty shops, barber shops. Make sure folks know there is an election coming up. They need to know how to register, and they need to know how and when to vote. We've got to tell them to push back against the cynics. Prove everybody wrong who says that change isn't possible. Cynicism does not fix anything. Cynicism is very popular in America sometimes. It's propagated in the media. But cynicism didn't put anybody on the moon. Cynicism didn't pass the Voting Rights Act. Hope is what packed buses full of freedom riders. Hope's what led thousands of black folks and white folks to march from Selma to Montgomery. Hope's what got John Lewis off his back after being beaten within an inch of his life and chose to keep on going. Cynicism is a choice, but hope is a better choice. And our job right now is to convince the people we're privileged to represent to join us in finishing that fight that folks like John started. Get those souls to the polls. Exercise their right to vote. And if we do, then I guarantee you we've got a brighter future ahead. Thank you. God bless you. Keep praying. But go out there and vote. God bless America.
All right. I did tell you it was going to be a little bit of torture, and I did not disappoint. What do you say? Here's the President of the United States, of course. I understand, you know, you're among your folks, and you can let your hair down a little bit, but you notice where he takes the speech. Right off the bat, he drags everybody back into 50 years ago with the passage of the Civil Rights Act. This is the same president, remember I had a program on it, standing in the shadow of Lincoln on the Mall with thousands and thousands and thousands of people assembled to mark the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which became effective in 1965. And what does he say? He tells them that the road ahead is long and hard. This is now 50 years since the passage of the Civil Rights Act and 238 years since the formation of the United States as an official country. And black folks have been waiting. And he tells them then, don't look to me. I'm not the one to give you the solution and the answer. I'm here to tell you how tough it's going to be after 238 years. And you listen to him tonight. Oh, it's a great razzle-dazzle speech. You think he's running for president all over again. But he has a mission. He gave a hint by starting the meeting or starting his speech with a tribute and recognition of Eric Holder, and he was careful to point out that Holder not only was the or is the U.S. Attorney General, but he was a judge and a prosecutor. Hello, did you put those things together? And how he'd spent almost 40 years as a dedicated servant of the people and fighting for justice and equality and trying to make a better, a more just criminal justice system? Ringing a bell yet? Yes! Don't be surprised if Eric Holder turns out to be a candidate for the U.S. Supreme Court. That's what that is. They're priming the pump. They're trying to see how it resonates with the people. And, of course, the crowd goes wild. Eric Holder is suddenly the man. You know, this was very interesting in that we have the president here really being a race man. This is a subject he never talked about. This is a subject he shied away from. He would never talk about racial disparities and the corrosive effect it has on American life. He wouldn't talk about the way society, white society operates and black society operates. He would never deal with these subjects for 6 years. And there he is. He's a race man. He's talking black talk. Oh, yes, he is. He is not mildly black. He's black now. He's presenting his authentic black self, talking about all these things that the unfinished business, he says, unfinished business that needs to be taken care of. That's right. Yeah. But so many good things have happened because his election has been very, very good for America. How do we know? He says, unemployment is down. And they applaud wildly because most of the people in the room are suffering from some kind of a disorder. They really are not in tune with their own communities. You have teenage unemployment in some cases that's higher than 80%. Among Native Americans, it's the standard unemployment rate is 80% and higher. Okay? So when you talk about unemployment being down, for whom? For whom is unemployment down? You're talking about the deficits are down. For whom? Who are these things down for? But he's careful to say the energy production is up. And how does this community benefit from that? That the auto industry is back? You need to talk to some people in Detroit and ask whether they think the auto industry is back. You need to talk to those people who don't have running water in their house, who've lost their houses, who are using empty acres for bathrooms. You need to talk to them and find out what a great quality of life is available to the African American community nationwide. The stock market is up. I am sure every black person is benefiting from that with their extensive investment portfolios. Corporate balance sheet is strong. Well, you're working in their service. It ought to be strong because you put all of the resources of the government made them available to the corporations. They ought to have a strong balance sheet. But here's this president now in the presence of the Congressional Black Caucus, and it's a pitiful lot. We've talked about them. You know, only one member of the Congressional Black Caucus had the fortitude and the moral conviction and suasion to say no to an additional $225 million on top of the $1.3 that Israel gets. No to more money for weapons to kill people in Gaza. Only one of them. So this is a whole gathering, a kind of thing organized as an ancillary effort for the Democratic Party. And that's why he sounds like a candidate. So first we get him introducing Holder in a way, and he did very nice and subtle. But he came back to it again, talking about how Holder has smartened up the criminal justice system. And his legacy, and he's using these kinds of words, drawing very interesting parallels to Thurgood Marshall. That's what all that is about. To say, here is our new Thurgood Marshall. And that's why this whole thing about the Civil Rights Act and the Civil Rights Movement and the Voting Rights Act, because they insist on keeping black America in a kind of time warp. You can't get out of this thing that they create, because that's where they put you 50 years ago. You're stuck there. They keep you there so that you can wax philosophic and you know, do that crossing of the hands and you hold other people's hands and you sway and sing, "We Shall Overcome." I keep saying they ought to change the title of that to "We Are Overcome." And this president has played a major role in subjugating his own people to some of the worst suffering that has been seen in the United States since the 1920s. He wants to put us all back to full employment. You know, there was a time in America there was no unemployment among blacks. Blacks were fully employed. They never got paid or anything like that, but they were fully employed. It's called slavery. So he shows up there and, you know, just throws out a whole bunch of stuff at you. Just throw them out. He's not talking anything substantive to people. And they applaud because, oh, that sounds good. Great, it sounds great. But everything he is talking about has nothing to do with self-determination or the increase of power commensurate with the investment made in him personally and in that dreadful Democratic Party. Nothing relates to the actual empowerment of his community. It's all about, well, philanthropic endeavors and what the government, we trying to do this and my brother's keeper and, you know, these nonsensical things. You talk symbolically to people because you have nothing of substance to say to them. You have no way of accounting for the fact that people have wasted their investment in you. This president has actually been a huge impediment to progress, not just for African Americans, but for the country. And you wonder why people put up with this thing and why they can't see that they need to resist it. All of this effort he now lays at the feet of black people who are suffering like hell. Your job, he's saying to them, you got to work. You've got to save America. It is now your job. You have to really redeem this country. And you can do that by your vote. The same thing that he's talking about, the same Voting Rights Act that they grudgingly gave to black people, like civil rights. You have no natural rights. They say, okay, we'll give you the right to live maybe for 20 years and then we'll revise. But if you should happen to get shot by a police officer, that officer is not subjected to criminal prosecution. We'll get a civil settlement and, you know, throw some money at you and your family, and that ought to make things square. But there is nothing of substance that this president can say after 6 years in office that has anything to do with the advancement of his community to empowerment. The improvement of their schools. He's talking about the importance of education. His administration has shut down more schools than all other administrations combined. The entire city of New Orleans does not have a public school anymore. And we've been talking about Detroit and Chicago and New York City and Philadelphia and Baltimore, Washington, D.C. All the black communities are under direct assault under this president. But he's there telling people, and they're applauding wildly about the stock market is up and corporations are doing very well. And these idiots are applauding. And they I guess the reason is they're so disconnected from their own communities. They're so unfamiliar with what people are really experiencing every single day. They no longer represent these people. They use these people, the president included, you're just a means toward an end. So get out there. Take on still toting that barge and lifting that bale. You, minions, go out there because we need you to go out there. Souls to the polls, he said, that offensive phrase. They don't tell anybody else that. They don't talk to other people like that. We come to talk to you as a president, and I'm talking this nonsense, I'm jiving, to put it in the vernacular. The president is jiving. You have no substantive report to deliver to people who have made twice extraordinary investments in your election to office, predicated on what he said. Hope. Predicated on hope that he would be an agent of change. That he would somehow change the formula of oppression and distress and lack. That he would, in some very important way, deal with these systemic issues. But the issues are dealt with in the context of, look at how much I could benefit from them. You know, Eric Holder, I've talked about Eric Holder, and one of the most incredible cases that he could have done something about and didn't, which was the murder of Amadou Diallo in his own house. He was sitting right there on his own stoop, trying to get back into his house because a bunch of white cops from nowhere started coming toward him with their guns drawn. And they shot him 19 times, bullets pierced his body. They shot him 41 times. He was, Eric Holder, was head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department at that time. Nothing came of it. And it is a sad chorus. A sad chorus of similar cases all over the country that were going on at that time. Nothing. But you're now in Ferguson. In fact, the Justice Department is in Ferguson today, having meetings. And while they're having meetings, people are still being shot in the streets like dogs. But he's introduced. And the president is very subtle. You would almost miss it if you're not listening closely enough. They're now packaging him as the next Thurgood Marshall, who was really an honorable man. But they're packaging Eric Holder to be the next U.S. Supreme Court justice. And that's what this whole thing about, this whole choreography. He quits so that there will be enough time to get somebody in behind him to pass through that horrible process, the confirmation process. And so he would be able to have enough of a cushion to make the rounds and get people used to him again as a black man fighting for black people. As a race man, as Adam Clayton Powell was called. But he was, of course, true and genuine. He really cared about America. And not just black America. He cared about America. I'm not suggesting that Eric Holder does not care. I'm suggesting that his record is kind of spotty. And this president, who has shown himself to be averse to the truth, shows up like a regular, you know, regional salesman and conducts this horrific example of, you know, it's a kind of a minstrel show. I know I'm a, he's got no accountability. He doesn't have to say anything substantive. He just needs to entertain. So he's there doing his song and dance, and they wildly applaud, as they always will. And basically, it is about making that plea that black people, the ones who are suffering, give up the one thing that they have that they could use as leverage to punish this unperforming Democratic Party and the president and whoever else is responsible for their condition, to give it up once again to the Democrats. So the good thing is that we hear and we are seeing a kind of revolution occurring in both Mr. Holder and Mr. Obama. They're becoming black people. It is a fascinating thing to see. They're stepping outside of their carefully constructed bourgeois confines and taking on attributes of, dare I say it, negritude. My, my, my. What's next? What's next? He may open up the next session with a Langston Hughes poem about what becomes of a dream deferred. You know, I've had it with this president. I've had it with the contempt and the cynicism that he talked about, that cynicism is a bad choice, but hope is a better choice. I think he's cynical toward the African-American community in particular, but he's just cynical across the board. This idea that he's smart, as he talked about, you know, a smart way of doing things. You're so smart that even your own generals are saying the exact opposite of what you're saying, and they have the knowledge about how to do a war. They're saying there are going to be ground troops that will be needed, and you say no because you're smart. You know these things because you went to Columbia and Harvard. You're a smart guy. I've had it. But I played this tape today just to show you again that African Americans are being treated in a trivial and casual way. Their concerns and their needs are really not very important. And none other than the President of the United States and people who are supposed to be part of his cabinet, who should be taking this mission on with a great degree of seriousness, have only been investing in their personal careers, what's good for them. They use the community, they have used the community and its support in the most contemptuous way, and they should never be forgiven for that. The Democratic Party must absolutely be punished. And this emotional problem that people have locked up with this vote, oh, I think it's time to rethink it. I think it is time to mete out some punishment. And the Democratic Party should be in the crosshairs of every conscientious person in America. Because what it has done in the last several years, going all the way back to Clinton, what it has done is unconscionable. The distress that we are seeing unfolding in cities like New York and Chicago and Detroit, especially Detroit, and that will continue, the onslaught against black people in this country is undeniable. And it is not just going to be black people. It's going to widen and take in a whole bunch of people who think, by virtue of the fact that they've been living as entitled folks in this race-based society, that they are immune from the vagaries of these things, they're going to wake up and see that it will consume them too. Like every other social, political, and economic problem that attacks the oppressed first, eventually it reaches others. Well, that brings me to the end of the program today. I hope it made some kind of sense to you. I share these speeches because it is important to hear from the president's own mouth the attitude toward blacks. It's very casual. It's very, you know, it's no big deal. Because he understands there's no great consequence to anything that he does. Black people just love him and pray for him, as he says. Black people need to start praying for themselves. That's what they need to do. So, stay tuned. Wake Up Call with Richard Martin is next. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking about these programs that I'm doing. And on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. It is always a great pleasure and a great delight to be in your esteemed company. I take this very, very seriously. And I try to bring you programs that would cause you to think or rethink things. Don't accept anything without first subjecting it to very thorough inspection, because the battle really is for your mind. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.